on this occasion of the, full moon day, which also is the day when, one of the days Shakyamuni Buddha showed miracles. And this month is called the Tibetan month, the month of miracles, and we have this tradition of giving teaching and reading the Jataka tales. During the time of the Buddha, it was said that the Buddha actually had a contest of miracles with non-Buddhist masters during his time. And this particular event is being commemorated in our Tibetan society. And it was started by this tradition of commemorating Buddha's miracles was started by Tsongkhapa, and for the last over 600 years, this has been going on in Lhasa. And then after 59, we have continued this tradition in exile. And also inside Tibet, due to thanks to the previous pension Rinpoche, this also was reinstituted in Lhasa, and we have been doing this ceremony or commemorating this event in exile as well. So, what are we commemorating here? The Buddha Shakyamuni, who lived around 2,600 years ago. We are remembering his great legacy that he has left for us. Generally speaking, we have other Buddhist, other teachers of other religious traditions, such as Mahavira of Jain tradition. And then there were other great masters of Indian religious traditions. And then after the Buddha came to this world, Jesus Christ, the founders of Christianity and Muslim Islam, and also lived, came to this world. And then there were also masters of Taoism and Confucianism and so forth in China. So Master Vasubandhu, who was the younger brother of Asanga, he makes this homage to the Buddha in the beginning of his Abhidhamma Kosha, treasury of higher knowledge, praising the Buddha for having overcome all his ignorance and also having become awakened and fully enlightened. So this is aware of everything. And then through his knowledge, he gave his teaching accordingly. The Buddha, according to Vasubandhu, the Buddha gave teaching which is about reality of things. And so the Buddha himself has said, O monks and scholars, just as gold is tested by rubbing, cutting, and burning, likewise you should examine my teaching and accept it, but not out of your devotion to me. And so he was referring to the monks, his disciples, and also the scholars. So just as gold is tested for its quality by burning, cutting and rubbing, likewise, the Buddha says, so just as the gold is tested like that, you should thoroughly examine my teaching as well. So he asked his disciples to investigate into his teaching. And so with regard to his teaching, the teachings which pertain to what is obvious to our senses. And so you have to check whether the teachings go against what is obvious. And then there are other sets of knowledge which are slightly obscure to us or hidden to the perceptual senses. And therefore, you have to use inferential cognition. And therefore, you have to use reasoning to come to the conclusions of those phenomena. And regarding the obvious things, we don't need to use reasoning as such to prove them. Regarding the slightly hidden phenomena, we need to use logic and reasoning so that we can draw conclusions, saying if something is this, then it should be that, and so forth. And in that way, having gained knowledge of what is obvious and also the slightly hidden phenomena through inferential cognition, then when you confirm these things pertaining the teaching of the Buddha pertaining to these things, then you should also be able to come to the conclusion of what the Buddha has said, and which actually the teachings which pertain to the very hidden phenomena, or extremely hidden phenomena, which cannot be either accessible to the direct perceptions as well as the normal inferential cognition. And therefore, based on the knowledge of the two phenomena, then you have to come to the conclusions of those teachings to be true, which are the teachings which teach the very extremely hidden phenomena. It's not that you have to take those things, those teachings, out of blind faith as such. So in this way, you have to check the teaching of the Buddha and try to see if his teachings are inconsistent with one another. And then you should also accept the teachings which actually stand to the test of reasoning. If they are true, then you have to accept them. So regarding the term, the Buddha, which in Tibetan is Sangye. So Sang means, can be referred to what is being purified or clarified, and what actually is the agent to clarify, and what actually happens through that clarification, or so what do you overcome or clarify is the faults that we have, the shortcomings. So it all comes down to our own experience of happiness and pain and pleasure. We all don't want pain, but we all want pleasure. Good experience. And therefore, what we need to do is we have to create the causes. We have to know that the causes which bring about happiness are the positive actions, and then those causes which bring about unhappiness or suffering are a negative. So since we don't want suffering, we have to get rid of the causes of suffering, and therefore clarify them. So how you go about with that is by knowing the reality. So one of the main causes of suffering is ignorance, not knowing the things correctly. And so the Buddha has said that the ignorance is the ultimate cause of our suffering and pain. So because of this, we cause pain to ourselves. So if we don't know the reality, if we don't know how to actually make our living properly, then we will not be able to make our living. And therefore, we have to know the causes and conditions. And then also with regard to health, we have to know what actually helps our health and what actually harms it. And then accordingly do what is necessary to overcome unhealthiness. And therefore, in the world, education is considered very important. Because of ignorance, people find it very important to overcome ignorance. And now, in order to overcome ignorance, we have to know the reality, which goes, this knowledge of reality goes totally or directly against this ignorance. And so the shortcomings or the faults that we have, in order to overcome it, we have to, the suffering, for example, because it comes through ignorance, we have to know the reality of things. Of course, within the knowledge of wisdom, we have the wisdom or knowledge of conventional phenomena and then also knowledge about the ultimate nature of things. And so with regard to the Madhyamaka philosophical view, in order to know that things are merely designated, that things are dependent in terms of being designated, we have to know the causality of the workings of causality. So all this knowledge that we actually try to gain in terms of the conventional and ultimate nature of things is in order for us to be overcome, able to overcome suffering and lead ourselves to liberation, freedom. So in order to reach that goal of liberation or nirvana, we must develop the wisdom or the insight into the ultimate nature of things. So how do we overcome or get rid of these faults that are within ourselves is by developing wisdom. So is there a possibility for that? Yes, because the mind has its own intrinsic nature. It has this inherent nature of being cognitive about things. We do not need to cultivate it afresh, but it is natural in us. And therefore, in order to the fact that we are able to learn things, know things, and perceive things is because of this very nature of the mind having the cognitive nature. And so because the mind is able to perceive its object, which is natural to it, therefore the lack of it is ignorance, and therefore, since the mind has the nature of knowing and being aware and also clarity, we have this natural potential within us to know things. And therefore, we can learn about things and go through the process of listening or studying things and then contemplating or reflecting on them and then doing meditation. So with regards to reflection, you should not just say, oh, this is so because my Lama says so, my teacher says so, but you have to try to use your reasoning and also try to see if the teachings actually are about the obvious things that we can see. And so the inferential or reflect, the wisdom drawn through reflection and can, should also rely finally go back get back at the perceptual knowledge of things. And so we have to use reasoning, investigate into the teachings. It's not enough just to listen to some teaching or lesson from a teacher and say that, oh, this is it, because my teacher says so. So after having listened to the teachings, then you should actually try to use reasoning and logic, whether there is any inconsistency in the teaching or whether there are any reasons to support it or not. And then you should, by using the reasoning, and logic, you should gain conviction and in the teachings. And then when someone else challenges you, you have reasons to prove what the teacher has taught. And otherwise, if you say, oh, this is so because my teacher says so, then if someone asks you if you ask your teacher whether this is true or not, and if you have to say that, oh, my teacher is not so sure, then it's not so good to believe in things without reason. And so within the teaching of the Buddha itself, there are those teachings which we can take literally and those which we cannot take literally. And so those which are, cannot be taken literally are said to be provisional teachings. And whereas those which can be taken literally, or in other words, the teachings which actually teach, the teachings of the Buddha which teach the ultimate nature of things are said to be ultimate, literal teachings, definitive teachings. So, for example, when you say, although something does exist, but you say it doesn't exist, then that is a misconception. And in fact, it's like denying things, existence to what actually exists. Whereas when you say that so that's kind of a deprecation of things. And then there is another misconception, which is to exaggerate about things, or saying that even though something doesn't exist, saying that it exists. And so all our education is about overcoming these two kinds of two types of misconception, exaggeration. Either you reify things or you deprecate them or deny their existence. So with regards to material development, I mean, it's happening each year. Things are becoming better and better. But we cannot go with what is accepted generally out of custom, but we should use reasoning and actually investigate into them. And through investigation, if you say, oh, maybe this was so and so, and maybe we believed in such and such thing before in the past, but then today when we check them, we find mistakes in them, therefore we cannot accept them. So in this way, you have to come to conclusions about the reality of things. And then over the centuries, things have changed. Our beliefs have changed about material things. And without doing any investigation, but accepting things just blindly, we make mistakes. And so it's very important in Buddhism to examine the teaching of the Buddha. So whatever it may be, Buddhism says that everything is interconnected. If things were not interconnected or dependent on other phenomena, other factors, then, of course, there is nothing which can be said to be true independently without relation to others. So there is no absolute truth or reality. So even good and bad are come about through and happen through many different factors, and there is nothing which come about independently without being contingent upon many factors. And in Heart Sutra, it says form is empty, emptiness is form, and form is not other than emptiness, and emptiness is also not other than form. And so, in Buddhism, it is said that everything is dependent on other factors, whether we talk about environment. If we can look at the environment, environmental issues from this perspective of interdependent nature of things, or in terms of economy, if we are not able to see how things actually can happen and what are the pitfalls that we may actually fall into, without knowing them, then we make mistakes, thinking that whatever you know is the truth and reality, and then just focusing on that, and then you make mistakes. And therefore, you have to look at things holistically from many different angles and not try to be stubborn, saying that, oh, this is it because of this, and not really using much reasoning. And so, with regards to Buddhahood also, you have to know what causes and conditions bring it about. You cannot have only one cause to become a Buddha. And so, because of lack of knowledge about this interdependent nature of things, we have made mistakes in terms of our environment and economy and so forth in the world. There are about 7 billion people. No one wants trouble. No one actually intentionally wants to create problem. But we have many problems, many of which are human creation. So we don't want problems and troubles, difficulties, but why do they happen? It is because we are not we lack the holistic view, and we only focus on this, very few causes and conditions in order to fulfill our goals, and that's a mistake. And so if we look at the situation inside Syria, of course the leaders didn't want problems, but because of their stubbornness, and then they are not able to go with reality. So as we see, we have to look at the example of others, of neighbors. If we look at things carefully, people who are very narrow-minded, who are very stubborn and wants to focus only on what they think is right, and then there are many problems. For example, in the case of nations like America, which is a very like a superpower, but we have lots of problems there, and it's the same with China. So people, the leaders, thinking only about their power and authority and not looking at things holistically. And also they should think about the Tibetan situation with a holistic perspective. So things have happened in the past through many different causes and conditions, and it's the same today. And people should not only force their own views and power, try to do things according to reality. So sometimes the Chinese leaders are very selective in what they want to hear about them, and they are not doing things according to reality. And so they have to do things according to reality. Deng Xiaoping has come up with this idea of finding truth through facts. So this is also consistent with the teaching of the Buddha. So why do we need to do that? Do we need to find truth through facts? Is because we don't want suffering, And we have to overcome suffering. And suffering has not come about without costs, but it has come through causes and conditions. So even the insects, the smallest insects, don't want suffering. And therefore, what we have to do is know the causes and conditions which bring about suffering and try to overcome them or avoid them. And develop knowledge and wisdom, because this alone can overcome the causes of ignorance, the causes of suffering. So regarding the term Buddhahood or Buddha, in Tibetan, as I said earlier, sang means to clarify or to clear ourselves of the negativities. So if you think of helping others, be altruistic and help them, and not being immoral, when you are actually, you have some opportunity to deceive others, which is immoral, you should actually guard yourself from actually indulging in that, thinking that, oh, this person looks very foolish, so I can actually deceive him. So you should not actually practice that. You should not deceive the person, even if you have the opportunity. So you should think that if I become immoral and others will be not like me, then because of that, because you are dependent on many of for many of your own goodness on others, therefore you should think that you should not make others unhappy, and you should therefore you should not also hurt others, harm others, because your happiness is dependent on them. And so, with regard to bodhicitta, this altruistic intention to become a Buddha for the sake of all sentient beings, the bodhisattvas are very wise, wisely selfish, as I usually say, because they forego their own happiness and for the benefit of others. So they give up self-cherishing attitude and actually cultivate and develop cherishing others more than themselves. And so therefore, they are wisely selfish people. So why do we need to be moral and ethical? Is because of wanting happiness. So if we need trust, if we want friends, we have to have trust. So in order to build trust, you have to be honest, transparent, and be think of helping others. So if you try to deceive others, if you try to be dishonest, then you will not be have friends. You will not gain trust from others. And so when we talk about being moral and ethical, it is for our own benefit as well. So if we could become examples to others in terms of practicing morality, we can, in a way, to a certain degree, reduce the suffering which we human beings ourselves create. So these problems or sufferings that we have created ourselves, we should have also the means to overcome and get rid of them. So if we are able to cause trouble and problems, then we also should be able to overcome them. So this is logical. To say such thing is logical. So Sangye Buddha is a very high level of attainment. So in order to reach that high goal, we should, in our day-to-day life, try to develop wisdom and see reality. and thereby avoid the causes of suffering and develop those causes which bring about happiness. So you may pray to become a Buddha, but without actually paying attention to your own nature now, your own condition, which is full of, that you are full of negative emotions, if you don't pay attention to this and try to reduce them, then you cannot actually start cultivating the path leading to Buddhahood by overcoming the gross or very coarse level of negativities that are within ourselves, because Buddhahood comes about by overcoming not only the coarse negativities but also the very subtle and fine tendencies, negativities, negative tendencies as well. And therefore, we have to know the workings of our minds, how the different thought processes happen in us, and how all these negative emotions, like the three poisons, happen in us. So the Buddhism teaches about how to overcome them and develop the positive qualities within ourselves, and through based on reason and logic. Whereas other religious traditions talk about keeping faith in their tradition, the Creator God, and so forth, and then reaching that through that they will reach heaven or and so forth. So of course these are good, but regarding Buddhism, its philosophical main philosophical thrust is in the teaching of selflessness. So when we study philosophy and Buddhist philosophy, we say that those even some certain Buddhist followers philosophically may not be considered Buddhist as such from that point of view. And therefore, the selflessness, teaching on selflessness or the view of selflessness, is the foundation of Buddhist philosophical understanding. And the Buddha has also said in certain at certain times that the five psychophysical aggregates are our burden, and the this burden is carried by the person. And so with that teaching, what the Buddha was actually saying, indicating to these disciples who need such teaching, was that there is a self-sufficiently, substantially existent self or a person. Because the subtle ultimate teaching of selflessness is not yet befitting those disciples, and therefore he gave such a teaching very skillfully. And so the teaching of the Buddha, which are translated into Tibetan, we have around 100 volumes of them. And then there are exegetical treatises, about over 200 volumes. So all these teachings, all these volumes of teachings have many different philosophical views that are taught according to the mental predispositions of the different disciples. And therefore, the teaching of the Buddha teaches us the means or the methods to actually transform ourselves from the level of a very beginner practitioner and leading us upwards. And so sometimes the Buddha, when you read the teachings of the Buddha, you find that as if the Buddha was actually teaching that there is a self. And then sometimes he also has given teachings saying that there is no external phenomena, but everything is mind and so forth. And so, amongst the 7 billion people in this world, about 1 billion do not have any religious belief, whereas the rest of the human population are supposed to be believers. So about 1 billion so there may be 1 billion Christians, 1 billion Muslims, and so forth. So I saw in a recently in a paper, I saw so where it said that out of the 7 billion, 6 billion are believers. And so it said about 6 billion were believers, and little more than 1 billion are non-believers. So which means about a sixth or the seventh of the human population on this earth are non-believers. So if we even amongst those who are said to be supposedly believers, if we look at them, I mean, how many do we find people who are actually lying to others, dishonest? So we cannot go about with these teachings. If you are following any religious faith, you can't. You cannot go about with them just as if it's a custom for you. So I tell Indian friends that India as a whole is a religious country, whereas there is so much corruption in it. So this is totally contradictory. So whereas you believe in God or some higher power and make prayers and requests to God, but while doing that, on the other hand, if you indulge in corruption, you are actually not paying heed to the teachings or the God that you believe in. So no God has given taught us to be dishonest and deceive others. So no religion teaches us to bully, oppress or bully others and deceive them. So people who say they are believers but indulge in corruption, in reality, they are not believers, we can say. So we have to respect all the religious traditions in this world. And we should have pure vision of them as well. And then, as I said earlier, amongst the those believers of other traditions, when we see people who indulge in corruption, even though they are supposedly believers, we have to take lesson for ourselves that we should not actually go against the teaching of the Buddha, but be sincere followers of the Buddha himself. And so we have to urge ourselves to become sincere followers of the Buddha as Buddhists. So developing compassion or warm hearts is fundamental to living a moral life. So if we examine the teaching of the Buddha, we can see what the Buddha teaches about reality. And then we can also look at the teachings or the writings of masters Nagarjuna and so forth. And today, even amongst scientists, usually when we talk about scientists, people in the West have this idea that scientists are non-believers, atheists. Whereas today, we have Of course, a genuine scientist should be unbiased, who should not say, something is this and that, because this is a tradition, or this is what we have been believing in. And so, even though some scientists may have said something in the past, but we should still investigate the truth about it. And so you have to be, scientists have to be unbiased. So those who are unbiased, scientists who are unbiased, so they, of course, with regard to Buddhist religion or religious faith, it is different. Whereas where the signs that we find in Buddhism and also Buddhist philosophy are appreciated by these unbiased, impartial scientists. And scientists who are neuroscientists also, having done experiment and investigation into the mind by using the knowledge that they find in Buddhism, they have found it very useful to bring about peace of mind. And so the teachings of the Buddha are something which we can verify through experiment and investigation. So do you understand? Do you get me? So as I quoted Vasubandhu in the beginning, who said that the Buddha teaches what accords with reality. So the teaching of the Buddha is about reality of things. And then there's so much detail given when the Buddha gave his teachings. And then particularly the Nalanda masters who used the system of logic and reasoning, which is marvelous, they have laid down the teaching of the Buddha in great detail, explained it. So for over 1,000 years, thanks to great Indian masters like Master Chandrakshita and Kamalashila, who came to Tibet and established Buddhism in Tibet using logic, and also Tibetan masters like Chabacheja Sengye and also Master Shakya Pandita have written texts on logic and epistemology. And this is what we used as a tool to study Buddhism in Tibet. So many of the things that we find in our classical texts may be things which were actually found in other treatises in the past, just following the tradition. But in Tibetan tradition, we have this rigorous study of philosophy and Buddhism through logic and reasoning. And so what I'm saying here is that I have interacted with many different people around the world, scholars of different traditions, and also scientists and so forth, so many different people from different backgrounds. And having discussed with them, I have found that Buddhism can actually make quite a good contribution in the educational field in the world with regard to the system of mind and logic and so forth. So sometimes I see that Tibetans are less interested in our own tradition, whereas there are many Westerners who take more interest in our tradition. So we have our own language. We don't have to rely on a second language to study the Buddhist text. We have the over 300 volumes of Ganjur and Denjur, and also commentaries to these written by Tibetan masters. thousands of them. So we have this as our own treasure. So with regard to historical accounts, of course, it's a different thing. But then with regard to the philosophy that we have, Buddhist philosophy, I mean, we have to, I always emphasize to for Tibetans to engage in study of these texts. So regarding the study, it is something that everyone, whether you're monks or nuns or lay people, everyone should do it. And then Kanjur and Tenjur, the more than 300 volumes of teachings of the Buddha that we have in translation from Indian language and others, have to be used as our textbooks for study of Buddhism. So many people actually agree with me to do that. So I'm not saying it, I'm not imposing some idea on you because I'm because of being a Buddhist, but I have never tried to propagate Buddhism in the West, in Western countries, but I sincerely explain the teaching of the Buddha to them. And after having listened to my teaching, it's up to the individuals to whether they choose, whether they actually want to keep the teaching or not for themselves. So even in our own tradition, for example, in the Vinaya text, it is said that unless you are requested to give some teaching, you should not go ahead and give teaching to others. And then even after, when you are requested for some teaching, you should not right away accept or agree to do that. You have to check the person who is requesting you the teaching. And then when you find that person to be really sincere and earnest listening to the teaching, and then receptive to the teachings, then you should go ahead to give the teaching to them. So I give lectures around the world. So I never tell them that they should be Buddhist, or I never tell them that the Buddhism is the best religion. So it seems these monkeys are very happy today because of the good weather. They're jumping around. His Holiness is saying, whatever you do up there, please don't pee on people. So they are trying to distract us, these monkeys. And so we have to know the value of our own treasure that we have. And then regarding Tibetan people as a race, we have our own language and script, so which is today the best religion or best language to explain Buddhism. Chinese and other languages are not like that. And Sanskrit is almost like a dead language, and even in English, I mean, we don't sometimes find the precise words for different vocabulary in Buddhism. And whereas when it comes to modern science, of course, Tibetan language is not sufficient, still not sufficient. Whereas when it comes to Buddhism and Buddhist philosophy, Tibetan language is the best. We have this language to ourselves. We don't have to rely on any other language to. So we have to become aware of this value of our treasure. So when you have valuable objects like jewelry or money and so forth, you have to put it in some safe. But with regard to knowledge of Buddhism, it is not like that. Even if you may put your text in some box and take it on your body, but without using it, it's no use. So you have to study Buddhism. So it's very important to study the text. So we may even call Buddhism our soul, Tibetan soul. So if you look at history, during the times of Chisung Dezen and Chirabachen, we made so much progress in Buddhism. And then later on, Tibetan nation became dispersed and fragmented. But even in such times, we are not talking about politics as such, but what actually has bound Tibetan people together, the whole of the Tibetan nation is our own religion and culture and language. So this is what we should actually think of preserving and promoting. So, without knowing the treasure that we have, and if we are not careful, then we may lose what we have. And so, in whatever field, whether it's science or economy or environment or politics, whatever we may be engaged in, you have to know the reality of things and then go and act accordingly. So this is my general introduction to Buddhism. So Je Rinpoche Tsongkhapa has praised the Buddha for teaching what accords with reality. And he also mentions that other followers of the other religious traditions or other thoughts traditions, because of propounding or the idea of Atman or soul, and they still cling on to some kind of a substantial entity of a self, and they cannot be... they cannot attain nirvana as such because of that. And so seeing this difference between the two traditions of Buddhism and others, the Master Tsongkhapa praises the Buddha. And so you should know what the teaching of the Buddha is about well, so that even if someone comes and challenges your belief, you can actually prove them. Through reasoning. And then in the past, the Chinese, communist Chinese have said that Tibetans Buddhism is only blind faith, and they have even some documents where they have said that in the 60s, the Chinese government has said that as science progresses, these blind faith will go away. But now we are in the 21st century. We are in the year 2013. But still, Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, has not vanished. So even great well-respected and renowned scientists admire Tibetan Buddhism, and which actually strengthens our religion and our philosophical tradition. So as I have been interacting in discussions with scientists for over 30 years, I became rather confident to hold a Mind and Life conference in our own monastic institutions. And so recently we had the Mind and Life 26th Mind and Life conference in Drepung monastic institution, of which there is, of course, video and audio recordings. And so the scientists were really happy, and they also visited the monastic institutions, and also because of the good interpreter, they really were happy to be there. So for about a week they were there. These renowned scientists stayed in the Tibetan community, and during the discussions, the Mind and Life conference, even the scientists were imitating the Tibetan monks in debate, clapping their hands while they were doing this, their own discussion during the conference. And so they really, during the conference, in the conference itself, as well as when they met me personally, they were really appreciative about what's their own experience of monastic life. And one of the scientists even told me that he was not a Buddhist, but he believed in past and future lives. So they are using their mind, their brain, and not being stubborn about their own views. And they were not trying to impose their own views and beliefs on others without any reason. But of course, they have learned Buddhism, and they admire it. And so in Buddhism, the Buddha has taught that things do not come about causelessly. So the Buddha himself, in the beginning, was like us, ordinary, totally ordinary sentient being. But because of the causes and conditions coming together for him, he was able to apply the antidotes to negative, destructive emotions, and practice the three, cultivate the three trainings of morality, concentration, and wisdom, and then overcome all the negativities and become fully enlightened. And when the Buddha appeared in India around 2,600 years ago, he, according to the Mahayana tradition, he came as a supreme emanation form of a Buddha, whereas he had become enlightened a long time before that in the form of Sambhogakaya. And so that in turn happens when somebody attains what is known as Dharmakaya. Within that, there is the wisdom Dharmakaya, the omniscient mind, which knows everything in one time, everything simultaneously. In other words, that mind is able to see both the truths directly, without them, intuitively, and therefore, in order to be able to attain that, you have to overcome the defilements that are within our mind stream. And so, one unless one has overcome both the mental defilements or obscurations known as afflictive emotions and the obscuration to knowledge, you will not be able to attain the omniscient state of mind. And therefore, the purification of these two defilements and have to happen. And therefore, the purification of these two defilements is the total purification of these two defilements is the Svabhavakaya of the Buddha. And so when you attain Svabhavakaya, then you also attain Jnanakaya, and you become a completely enlightened one and attain Sambhogakaya, and from there emerges the Nirmanakaya, or the emanation of form of a Buddha. And so, with regard to the Jataka tale, so the 28th chapter is the chapter on teacher of restraint, and then that was finished, and then the 29th chapter is a visitor from Brahmalok. So we talk about the three planes of existence: desire realm, form, and formless realms. So desire realm is the realm where beings are attached to the sensual objects, the very coarse sensual objects, the five sensual objects. So our material development happens focused on these sensual objects, whereas in the non-Buddhist tradition, the true practitioners are not contented with contented with the sensual objects, but they focus on the internal, developing the mind internally. And therefore, they have what is known as the Brahma vehicle. And then there is the vehicle which is called the vehicle of humans and gods, where we have the practices of paying homage and respecting gods and deities and so forth. And then there is also some vehicle which focuses on cultivating concentration, single-pointed concentration, and without being attached to the five external essential objects. I was supposed to go to Mahakumbh Mela, one of the Indian festivals. So we set a date, and then the situation was not good. And then we also set another date, and because of the weather, I couldn't go. So I felt very sad for not being able to go to Mahakumbh Mela this time. So I had been to three of the Mahakumbh Melas, which happens every 12 years. So the next Mahakumbh Mela is going to be when I am about 90, 92, 90. So 90, so it would be very difficult for me. So I would have to say I have no idea about Ma Kumbhamela at that time. So I wished I could visit. And I was thinking of meeting with many religious leaders, and also I wished also send a message that I wanted to meet some meditators, Hindu meditators. So there are these people who actually see the attachments to these coarse sensual objects as being negative. And then they focus on cultivating single-pointed concentration. So in our classical text, there is mention of 16 different levels within this form realm. And then there are the four formless realms. In Kala Chakra, there's mention of 31 different planes of existence, starting with the lowest hell realm up to the highest formless realms. So, generally speaking, we can see there are many different levels of the subtlety of mind. So there is a mind which is active when we are distracted, and then there is the state of mind during concentration. And because of the difference in the causal level, we can say that there are the results which also are different in terms of the subtle degrees of mind, the levels of subtlety within the mind. So earlier, in the beginning, we made the mandala offering with the Buddhist cosmic structure, with Mount Meru in the center. We made this offering, Mount Meru, surrounded by the four continents and then the subcontinents and so forth. But with regard to Mount Meru, if it's supposed to be an object that is accessible to our direct perception, we should be able to see it, whereas we cannot see it. So in our logical texts, there are arguments against non-Buddhist traditions for non-Buddhist beliefs and thoughts, saying that, oh, if you say so, it has to be accessible, because what you are saying is something not hidden phenomena, but it's in something which is obvious to the senses. And while we argue against them with such reasoning, if we cannot put up with the same logic for when it comes to our own tradition, it's not so nice. So, so the universe is limitless, and we talk about the Big Bang. So from there started all these different universes. Of course, with regard to the creation or the evolution and then destruction, finally, of the different world systems that are explained according to science, they also are accord with what our classical texts say. And then there are the subtle elements of fire and so forth that are taught in our texts. So in Mahayana Uttara Tantra, there is mention of the five elements, like space element, wind or air, and then fire, water, and earth. So when it explains about the evolution of the universe, it starts with the space element, then comes the wind, and then the fire and so forth. So there is space first. so which is inanimate. And Kesum Norsang Gyatso, one of the Tibetan masters, has said that when someone actualizes what is known as the luminous or clear light nature of the mind, there is this experience of as if there the spaciousness or emptiness. And so he, even in the tantric text, there is the use of the four empties. When we go through the dissolution process of the elements in our body, in ourselves, there is the explanation of the four empties. And so a similar dissolution process happens in the external world as well. So to go through the Jataka tale, it is said that the Buddha was once born in one of the Brahma worlds. So in one of the Bhagwan's previous lives as a Bodhisattva, because of his constant practice of meditation and his vast store of good karma, led him to take a shape of a Devarshi dwelling in the realm of Brahmalok, the region of the heavenly delights. Through the ripening of the merits engendered in countless past lives, he had earned the privilege of enjoying the blissful meditations of gods. So even when the Buddha was born in such a realm, he continued the practice of cultivating or further cultivating the bodhicitta, the altruistic mind of intention to become a Buddha for the sake of all sentient beings. So the story is about the Buddha being born in, as a bodhisattva in the Brahmalok, and he was to tame or an evil king who did not pay heed to the law of causality and indulged in all kinds of negative actions. And so the essence of the message here is we all don't want suffering, but want happiness. It is our own experience that tells this to us. Both of pain and pleasure come from their causes and conditions. And therefore, with regard to the causes and conditions of pain and pleasure, or the pain and pleasure themselves can be categorized into the physical and the mental. So physical ones are something which is common to even the animals. When they have their fill, they have no danger, and then there is no problem with weather. Of course, they live very happily. Whereas us humans, we have this marvelous brain with which we can actually think about different... We have lots of thought processes going on in our head. And so the physical pain and pleasure compared to the inner or mental pain and pleasure is negligible. And the mental pain and pleasure are much stronger. So even if you may have some very intense pain, physical pain, and you have may have gone through surgery and you're in pain, but if your mind is calm, then the physical pain doesn't really disturb you. Whereas even if you may have all the necessities of life, but if you are disturbed in mind, you have no peace of mind, then you will not enjoy the facilities that you have. And then because of our intelligence, we also have more powerful memory. We can actually have memory of human history, which has things that have happened hundreds of years ago. And then, accordingly, we can also have lots of thoughts going on in our head pertaining to what happens to us or what will happen to us. And so, Chö, or religion, or for example, in the case of Buddha, Buddha Dharma, means making transformation within ourselves so that we create the causes for more blissful or happy experiences and to overcome the causes of unhappiness. So when we talk about making offerings to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and Lama, and so forth, the main offering is our own practice of Dharma, which is to say, to transform, make transformation within ourselves, to overcome our negative emotions. And so Milarepa, Jitun Milarepa has said, I don't have the material offerings to give to my teachers, but I have the offering of my practice to please my guru. And so, without actually applying the teachings within yourself to make internal transformation, even if you may go around the temple and make offerings of material things, I mean, it will not help much. And so, Chö, or Dharma, mainly is about making transformation within. And so, in this story, the king finally sees the reason and logic in practicing the Dharma and then became tamed with the help of the Bodhisattva. Through the ripening of the merit engendered in the past lives, he had earned the privilege of enjoying the blissful meditation of God. However, because of his practice of compassion in previous lifetimes, even this supreme joy did not turn him from the desire to benefit others. So what the this Jataka tale is saying is showing us is that our pain and pleasure come through causes and conditions, and it teaches about causality, law of causality of things. So even the animals are able to sense threats to them, what threats may come to them, and then they accordingly protect themselves. Their birds make their nests in safe places where there is no threat or danger, and then this story also teaches about past and future lives, which has to be understood on the basis of the continuation of the mind, the continuity of the mind. Some scientists, modern scientists, say that there is no such thing as a mind separate from the brain. It's only the brain activity that gives rise to consciousness. So I have met some scientists who say this, and then I asked him or her, then I told him that we as humans are able to know about what has happened in the past, like in the 18th or 19th centuries. How does that happen? I asked him. I mean, he didn't have much explanation. And so we have, as humans, our language. And then, accordingly, we also have the different vocabularies, and these vocabulary also are used according to our own thought processes. So within the mind, there are those which are perceptual, and then there are those which are inferential or conceptual thought mind. So conceptual mind or conceptions actually work in such a way that there is the element of what is known as the principle of elimination or exclusion. So when we think about one thing, we are not able to think about others at the same time. And when you accordingly, our language also works in the same way. So the brain that we have is only for one life. So if we talk about remembering the things that happened happened 2 or 3 centuries ago, I mean, how do we explain it on the basis of the brain cells itself? And this scientist was very unhappy because of his mother. He was worried about his mother, and how should he actually get rid of his worry? When I have discussions with scientists, I'm not talking about past and future lives as such. And of course, in the case of the Christians, they don't believe in past and future lives. But when people ask me frankly this, then I talk. Recently in South India, I asked whether the mere coming together of a semen and ovum, sperm and ovum, can give rise to human consciousness or not. Sperm and ovum, which are perfect without any defects, as soon as these two come together and forms a gamete, is it possible that you can say there's consciousness or not? So why does that happen? If right at that point, if there's no conception. So this shows there is a third condition necessary for conception of a human being. And so this birth or conception has the relation to what is also known in the 12 links of dependent origination as becoming or existence. So when it in the physical world, we have to have continuation of the things in terms of the substantial cause. And so similarly, in the world of mind, we have to have substantial cause for a next moment of consciousness. Whereas for the what is known as a cooperative condition, we can have, even if a mind has its own substantial cause, there could be cooperative conditions which are physical. And therefore, the substantial cause has to be a previous moment of consciousness or mind. And so for a rebirth or conception in a mother's womb, we should have a continuation of her mind that has existed in the past, and therefore we can talk about the existence, the tenth limb or link in the 12 links of dependent origination. And then there are other factors which also play their role in bringing about rebirth or conception, such as those of the craving, grasping, and so forth. So the external world in which the sentient beings live have also some connection with the sentient beings who are born into it. And within the sentient beings, we have the different subtle elements. And therefore, within these different elements comes also the a consciousness element for rebirth to happen. So worldly people absorbed in things sensual or material become thoughtless, but the virtuous, even when absorbed in the delight of meditation, are never distracted from their task of helping others. And so it happened that a great being was gazing down on the desire realm below, a sea of moral illness, disaster and calamity, where hundreds of painful occurrences, evils and suffering continually afflict living beings. In this realm, where compassion finds its sphere of action, he perceived the king of Videha, Angadina by name, wandering in a wilderness of harmful views, partly from association with bad company, partly from his own strong attachment to wrong views. The king hath come to believe that there is no other world than this one, and that no one can be certain of the results of good and evil action. Following this view, he lost all interest in spiritual pursuits and turned his back on acts of charity. He scorned good conduct, and because of his lack of faith, felt nothing but contempt for the holy books and for those who led virtuous lives. Laughing at the tales of other realms, disrespectful of everything holy, he showed little honor to Shramanas and Brahmans, and gave himself over to sensual pleasures. His Holiness is finding his page, and he who steadfastly believes in life hereafter, where good and evil ripen naturally into happiness and suffering, finds balance and stability. But he who rejects faith is caught in the web of desire. Consequently, Angadina's conduct and views were creating problems and suffering for his people, a state of affairs that aroused the compassion of the high-minded Devarshi. One day, when the king was enjoying himself in a lovely arbor, idly pursuing his pleasures, the Bodhisattva descended in his brilliant chariot before the king's very eyes. On beholding the luminous being, blazing like fire, pulsating like a ball of lightning, radiant as a million suns, the king, overwhelmed and alarmed, arose from his seat and with palms respectfully joined, asked the being who stood before him, "Who are you? You whose form delights the eye, O being with lotus feet, O being who walks in the sky and shines with the luster of the sun." The Bodhisattva replied, "Know me, O king, as a devarshi of the Brahmalok, who has gained the region of heavenly delights through the power of my mind's clear composure, which vanquishes both desire and hatred. Those two proud foes resembling chiefs of hostile armies in battle." On hearing this, the king, with kind words of welcome, offered the great being the hospitality due to a worthy guest, water to wash his feet, the various offerings. So in Buddhism, we talk about the basis, which is the ground, about the reality of things, and then there is the path which we proceed along. And so when it comes to teaching of the Buddha first gave the teaching on the Four Noble Truths. So first he recited the Four Noble Truths according to their in terms of their nature or identity. And so he says, and then next he talked about the Four Noble Truths from the point of view of their functions. So, which means that the suffering has to be known, and the cause or the origin of suffering must be overcome. And then the path must be cultivated, and the cessation or true cessation must be cultivated or actualized, and the true path cultivated. And so, In order to overcome suffering completely, you have to, and to reach liberation, you have to overcome the causes of suffering completely and reach cessation or liberation. And therefore, the cessation so with regard to the Four Noble Truths, each have their four characteristics or attributes. And so cessation, with regard to cessation, the four qualities are like excellence and so forth. And then we have the four attributes of the path, which is the path that you cultivate. And then path also has the attribute of knowing or becoming aware of things. And because of this knowing or being aware of the nature of things, reality of things, you are able to see reality and therefore overcome ignorance and thereby overcome the cause of suffering. And in this way, you cultivate the path. And so the Buddha gave teaching on this path, the Four Noble Truths, to the king. And was able to get rid of his wrong views and also being stubborn about his own beliefs and thereby turning the king into a very humble person. Water to his feet and various offerings, gazing admiring on the Devarshi face, Devarshi's face. The king asked the Holy One, "You are wonderful indeed to be able to float in the air so effortlessly, even passing through walls. Tell me, O being bright as lightning, how come you, came you by this natural power?" The Bodhisattva replies, "Such powers are the natural results, O king, of meditation, moral conduct, and restraint of the senses. After countless lives and constant practice, I have achieved such results as this." Angadina sighed. "Do you really think there is such a king as a world beyond? Thing as a world beyond?" So His Holiness stops the Jatakate.